Thank you, Judge. Good morning, Your Honors. Pam Pepper on behalf of Kenneth Craig. I'd like to get right to the jurisdictional issue, which obviously I think is the most cogent one for the court to determine whether or not to go forward with this. As the government accurately stated in its brief, Kimberland is the controlling case in terms of whether or not the question of timing should be governed by when Mr. Craig placed his notice of appeal in the mail.
Actually, counsel, I think there's an antecedent question, which is, should we pay any attention to these multiple affidavits that have been filed in this court? Because they seem incompatible with what Craig told the district judge. When he asked for an extension of time, he said, well, it's true, I didn't begin this process until after the 10 days had run, and here are my reasons. The district court says they aren't good reasons, your application is denied. And now he is telling a different tale. Why should we allow him to contradict himself? And it seems to me either what he told the district court is a lie or what he's telling us is a lie. But they can't both be true.
That's certainly accurate, Judge, and I think part of the explanation for that may fall in my communications with Mr. Craig. As the court knows, Mr. Craig is incarcerated, and I was not aware that he had filed a notice of appeal until long after he had filed a notice of appeal, and so I began to communicate with him both by mail and at least on two occasions by telephone to try to find out what exactly had happened. And I'm not entirely sure, to be totally honest with the court, that I completely got it right. I believe that the first time I talked to him, he told me I didn't decide to appeal until after the 10 days was over.
That's certainly what he told the district court.
Then when I talked to him later, I began to understand that what he was saying was, I had decided it before then, but I was afraid that if I tried to call you on the telephone with a collect call, you wouldn't be there, I wouldn't be able to get through within the 10 days, and so I didn't contact you, and I ended up putting it in the mail when I put it in the mail. I can't honestly tell the court that that was not a result, those two different statements are not a result of my somehow not apprehending what Mr. Craig was telling me.
Yeah, the alternative understanding is that he realized the truth did him no good, so he decided on a different strategy.
That certainly is an alternative understanding, Judge, and I can only represent to you what my conversations with him have been. I can't tell you what was in his brain at the time. He's obviously indicated now in a later affidavit that he placed it in the mail on the date that he indicates.
Of course, his affidavit itself doesn't comply with the rule because it does not indicate that first-class postage was prepaid.
That's correct.
The rule requires only two things, and the affidavit gets 50% of them.
Right.
Shouldn't.
No, Judge, I can't with a straight face argue that this court that these proceedings have been in compliance with the rule. They haven't been. And I guess the difficulty that I have is taking Mr. Craig at his word.
I think that you should say taking Mr. Craig at his words.
Okay. Taking Mr. Craig at his various words. I believe that he has indicated to me several times a misapprehension of what my obligations were and to what extent he could validly rely on me to file the notice for him. That's what I've been attempting to redress through the, as you know, numerous documents that I filed with the court, trying to update the court on the information I got from Mr. Craig and what he told me about what had happened at the facility. So whether his two conflicting statements, if they are in fact conflicting and not a result of my misunderstanding, are an indication that somehow or another he's acting in bad faith with the court, I don't believe that he is, but of course that's my representation based on the relationship I've had with him and the conversations that I've had with him. If the court does in fact accept the submissions that have been made and gives them some credence, then I think in light of Kimberlin, there's not much of an issue that he was in fact represented at the time that this item was placed in the mail and in fact during the 10 days in which he was entitled to file a notice of appeal. The only issue seems to be his somehow misunderstanding that that was the case. His feeling that for whatever reason, whether he couldn't, because of kids couldn't contact me, or because he felt that counsel was no longer appointed to him after the 10-day appeal period had expired, he didn't feel that he had the benefit of counsel. So represented clients certainly have to file within the 10 days. Unrepresented clients have a bit of a grace period under Kimberlin in terms of when they place the item in the mail. The question is, what happens to a client who is in fact represented but somehow or another doesn't grasp that fact? And it is my perception that that's where we are with Mr. Craig. And I've simply asked the court to consider that fact in determining whether or not to reach the merits. Unless the court has any further questions on the jurisdictional issue, I can move briefly to the issue on the merits. The question on the merits, of course, as the court is aware, is whether or not Judge Clifford erred in not inquiring of the defense with regard to the consecutive versus concurrent sentence issue. Again, as we've indicated in the brief, I could have objected to the fact that the court didn't ask and, in fact, could have inserted some discussion on that matter and didn't, and therefore this court's reviewing for plain error. The main issue that I'd like to address with regard to that plain error analysis is, at one point, the government indicates that one of the things, obviously, that has to be proven in terms of a plain error analysis is that the fact that the result would likely have been different, or there could have been an impact on the outcome had the error not occurred. I'd simply like to note for the court that I think the impact on the outcome would have been, had Judge Clover had an opportunity to consider it, the impact would have been that Mr. Craig, as a result of having a consecutive versus a concurrent sentence, was likely to be ineligible, in fact is ineligible, for certain Bureau of Prisons programs and for certain types of placement. And Judge Clivert made several statements during sentencing about certain positive statements during sentencing about Mr. Craig, clearly thought that Mr. Craig had the opportunity and the ability to make some changes in his life if he chose to do so. I believe that it would have made an impact on Judge Clivert's decision had he had an opportunity to give some consideration to the issues surrounding placement and the issues surrounding the programs that would have been available to Mr. Craig. Are there any other questions I can answer for you on either of those two issues? Thank you.
It doesn't look like it. Thank you, Ms. Pepper. Ms. Jacobs.
May it please the court, good morning. Again, I'm Michelle Jacobs for the United States. Just assuming that the defendant's representations here are somehow confused and not in bad faith or dishonest,
I'm not worried about confusion. I'm just worried about the facts. When Craig asked the district court for more time, did he convey his views by affidavit or in some other way?
I don't recall that there was an affidavit. I do not recall there being the affidavit.
How were Craig's views conveyed to the district court?
The notice of appeal was filed, and thereafter there began a series of filings. I think there was a letter, if I'm not mistaken, that went to the court, and then there were a series of conversations through counsel, and then Ms. Pepper got involved. But as Judge Eastbrook, as you pointed out,
I'm trying to figure out what it was that Craig himself told the district judge. And Ms. Pepper suggested that perhaps the proceedings in the district court reflected her misunderstanding of Craig. And I'm trying to figure out whether that's the way to think about it or whether there are things that Craig himself told the district judge.
I would have to look back at the docket, Judge, to make sure, because there have been so many different representations about what he knew and when and when things were deposited.
Exactly.
I don't recall.
That's why it would be nice to get our hands on the representations to the district court.
Right.
Because I must say, I don't see why, having gone through this proceeding in the district court seeking an extension of time, any litigant, Craig or anybody else, should be allowed to change his tune on appeal in this court. But if, in fact, it's not a change of tune, but maybe it's a change of what the attorney is representing about an old tune, that would cast a different light on it. So we need to find out what Craig has been saying.
My best recollections, without going through the docket, and I don't have the docket sheet in front of me, was there were four filings by Ms. Pepper, starting with the motion for extension. And in those motions, there were representations made about her conversations with her client. But I have in my mind that there may have been one communication directly with the judge, but without looking at the docket, I'm not certain of that.
All right. Well, we'll just have to look at the record then. Okay. So why don't you go ahead.
Thank you. But again, assuming that for some reason, through these conversations with counsel, there was some confusion about, and not bad faith, as there was some discussion before on Mr. Craig's part. We still believe, the government believes and submits that Kimberlin does control, and that I don't think that there's much question in this record, but that Mr. Craig knew that he was represented. Judge Clifford found that in his order. He stated it during the sentencing when he gave him his appeal rights. The district court specifically told him that the representation would continue. Ms. Pepper has represented in the jurisdictional memoranda that she reminded him of the continued representation when she met with him, and that Craig did not contact her. Given all of that, given her obligations under the circuit rule to continue representation, Kimberlin would seem to control. The only, I suppose, slight twist on that here is whether the defendant, as Ms. Pepper said, really...
I don't know how Kimberlin could control. Kimberlin doesn't construe the language of Rule 4C, which wasn't adopted until 2 years after Kimberlin. Right? What controls is the language of 4C. Kimberlin can't even be a gloss on it because it came 2 years later. Now, one might say that we should construe the language of 4C the same way Kimberlin construed the common law mailbox rule. But that's very different from saying that we've actually got an authoritative decision out there. Is there any reason why we should construe the language of 4C to limit its application to unrepresented defendants? The language doesn't seem so limited.
From my reading of Kimberlin and the Houston case in the Supreme Court, there are continuing references to the difference between represented...
Houston was a gloss on a rule that no longer exists. It was replaced in 1992 by Rule 4C. So Houston and Kimberlin don't count for beans. Rule 4C is what controls that particular question. The question I'm asking is there any reason why we should construe Rule 4C to be limited to unrepresented defendants? Unrepresented litigants, technically, broader.
Well, again, my best reading of those cases would seem to be that after Rule 4C and the application that...
Kimberlin precedes Rule 4C.
I understand
it's
that.
It's irrelevant.
Okay. Well, my reading of Rule 4C, that they are supposed to... The way that the notice of appeal is supposed to be filed and the timing is construed for... incarcerated prisoners, I believe that the mailbox, if I might call it the mailbox rule, would apply to incarcerated prisoners. There does not seem to be a reason or indication that
the problem is Rule 4C refers to, quote, an inmate, quote,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't say an unrepresented inmate. It doesn't say a confused or ignorant inmate. It just says an inmate. Why should we not construe Rule 4C to mean what it says? We live in a world of textualism, the Supreme Court keeps saying. Why should we add a word to the rule that is not in it?
Well, perhaps you should not. My best reading of those cases and the practice that represented litigants are in fact represented, and their motions and filings come through counsel. Would seem to indicate, along with those cases, and I understand those cases preceded the change in the rule, but given all of that, I would submit that it still would only apply to unrepresented prisoners. The represented prisoners have the ability, through counsel, to file without
that's
the need for
reason,
that rule.
That's a reason why Rule 4C might have been written differently. But is it a reason why Rule 4C should be read differently than it is written?
I'm sorry, I just didn't understand I didn't understand your question.
Go ahead.
Well, let me move to the merits. I believe this court does not have jurisdiction for all the reasons that are set forth in the brief. But if this court finds that it does have jurisdiction, I would submit that no plain error was committed here by Judge Clevert. He clearly, on the record, understood that he had the authority. He says as much when he says, I have the authority, though, to impose at least a partially concurrent sentence if I believe that's appropriate. He had the knowledge and the authority that he had, that he was able to impose a concurrent or consecutive sentence. The case law is pretty clear that he did not need to set forth the reasons for the consecutive sentence because of 3584. The application note 6 to the guideline clearly directs that a consecutive sentence is an appropriate sentence in this case, and for all of those reasons, there's no plain error here. The defendant, in addition, clearly had an opportunity, although didn't take it, had the opportunity to object after the imposition of the sentence. Judge Clevert asked, actually, at the very end, was there anything else? The answer was no. And so, under the plain error standard, I would submit that the sentence is appropriate and should be affirmed. If the court has no further questions, thank you.
Thank you. Anything further, Ms. Pepper?
Just quickly, Judge, if I could shed some light on the question you were asking Ms. Jacobs with regard to Mr. Craig's communications with the court. My recollection, Judge, is that Mr. Craig didn't have any communication directly himself with the court relating to why his notice of appeal was filed when it was. Those communications all came from me. I believe Ms. Jacobs is right. He did have one communication with the court on his own. I believe that was a communication saying, okay, I filed this notice of appeal, now what do I do, sort of communication. I don't believe that he directly made any representations until the filing of the affidavit later on in the proceeding after I had become aware and gotten involved again, if that clarifies that somewhat.
Okay.
Thank you, Judge.
Good. Thank you very much, counsel, and we appreciate your accepting the appointment and your assistance to your client and to us.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement. The third